Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in studio today is Dr. Yasmin Adam, head of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in Johannesburg. Dr. Yasmin Adam has been the head of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology since April 2013. She has been a specialist in obstetrics and gynecology since 1995 and holds an MSc in epidemiology and biostatistics. She has a special interest in the treatment of cervical cancer precursor lesions and has been involved in the development of the South African Guidelines for Cervical Cancer Prevention. Additionally, she examines, supervises, and teaches both undergraduates and postgraduates and presents her work at local and international congresses and publishes in peer-reviewed journals. Welcome to the show, Dr. Adam.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Adam, the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital is one of the largest hospitals in the world. My understanding is it's got in excess of 3,000 beds. It services the community of Soweto and is also a referral hospital for other areas in South Africa. You're currently heading up obstetrics and gynecology. Can you please tell us more about your role?
I think heading a department like that is challenging. Some days it's really, really difficult, but most times I absolutely love it. It's the biggest hospital, I think, in Africa, and we deliver almost 23,000 deliveries a year.
23,000 babies?
Yeah. So, and that's just on the obstetric side. On the gynae side, we see about 100 new patients every day. And that's just new patients, so that's not all the work that we do because obviously they have to come back. Some of them will need operations. Some of them can be treated medically. So it's a huge challenge.
That's an incredible volume of people that move through, 100 new patients a day. Wow.
I once told a colleague that I was saying, you know, that we were seeing about 100 patients, and they said, is that in a month? And that's actually in a day.
To manage that volume, what is the support structure like? How many doctors do you have attending in the department?
We have 100 doctors. That's probably a third who are interns, a third who are registrars, and those are registrars are doctors who are specializing in obstetrics and gynecology. And a third who are consultants. So they are either specialists or they've completed their registrar training and are waiting to write exams.
And over and above the doctors, you've also got the support staff comprising of nurses and...
And social workers, dietitians, physiotherapists, occupational therapists. They don't all only work for obstetrics and gynae, so that we share the support services with other departments.
But they still fall under your jurisdiction when they're working within the department?
Yes.
Can you share some of the milestones in your career and what you think has impacted on you the most?
I think that one of the things was that I was one of those people who knew what I wanted to do from the time I was really little. So I always knew that I wanted to do medicine. And it was just focused in that direction. Everything I chose was in that direction. And then I qualified as a medical practitioner in 1985. And then one of the other big things in my life, I guess, are my children. So I have three children, and that's one of my highlights in my life. And then going to specialize. After I specialized, I went into private practice for about 8 years. And it wasn't bad at all. It gave me a lot of flexibility, but I really wanted to go back. I always wanted to go back. And when I got the chance to go back, I did. Into public service. I never, ever left. I always did a clinic. I continued to do a clinic even when I was in private practice. That was the colposcopy clinic, which is looking at pre-malignant lesions of the cervix, and that was always. And then I went back. When I went back, there was position for me, so that was good. And then I became a senior specialist, and then when the post for head of department became available, I applied for that, and that is now I'm head of department for about a year.
And during your career, there's a lot of changes that we have through one's lifetime. But as your experiences as a doctor, when you started your career until today, have you encountered any gender challenges?
When I started medicine, there was already 50% women in the class and 50% men. Although there was a problem in terms of race, so we were 27 black students in our class, and
as
out of a class
percentage
of about, it was about 250, but say let's say 200, so it would have been 13-14%, was black, and that was the thing. But the gender was 50%, and that has remained. But in terms of specializing, when I was specializing, more than 50% of the doctors who were specializing were male. But today it's changed completely. So much so that it's probably, we're getting close to 70% close to 70%. And we joke about it, you know, when we have interviews, we're starting to say, you know, should we give extra points to males? So it's great.
And with the 70%, is that on the obstetrics and gynecological side or just in general?
I'm not sure about the other specialities, but for obstetrics and gynae, there's definitely more women now. It may also be, you know, that as the democracy has matured, that you having people who are starting off doing medicine and there's more people and they don't have such a big family base to go out and look after. I mean, I remember from my friends early on when we had just specialized, some of my friends, you know, were leaving because they came from a community where they were the only doctor in the whole community. The whole community looked up to them. Or they had other brothers and sisters who never made it, and so they had a whole family looking up to them. And it's almost like now you finished, you have to pay back.
So there's a lot of pressure and expectation and responsibility.
Yes. And I think that is now changed, that there's, you know, with more and more women and coming into the speciality, there's more room for specialization, and there's not this community pressure to go out and contribute again or work as a GP.
It's interesting that the specialization is growing beyond just being on the general practitioner side.
Yeah, I think that may be one of the ways in which the national health system will be better, is that if you flood the market with so many obstetricians, gynecologists, that more will stay in the state, and that there then may be a public-private partnership and make it, you know, and make the National Health Initiative work.
Well, that's the direction that the country wants to go into, and towards national health. Mm. Dr. Adam, can you tell us, have you had the opportunity to work in Africa or collaborate with any other hospitals in other countries on the continent?
I think that before 1994, you know, we weren't even allowed to go to many of the countries in Africa because we weren't, as South Africans, there were those countries that you could go to on holiday. I remember going to a conference in Mozambique, and we were only allowed because we were allowed as special guests. So we weren't allowed to contribute, but we were also excluded as South Africans, but it was just because of the political nature of some of the stuff that we were doing that we were allowed to go there. So that was it. But otherwise, we have many doctors from Malawi, Ghana, DRC, Nigeria, who are coming to specialize with us. And it's excellent because a lot of them are excellent doctors, and it's great to see that the training is so similar at an undergraduate level, but they obviously don't have the opportunity to train in those countries. So they don't get paid when they come here. They come on a bursary. So they, so for them, it's a sacrifice, and they come on a bursary, which allows them to train and specialize, but they have to go back after 4 years, and that I guess will increase the number of specialists there.
But that's a really good way of being able to educate other people within the continent, put that shared learning over, and upskill where there's a skill shortage.
Yeah. No, definitely. So we have 27 registrars and 4 supernumerary registrars. So they from outside of South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Malawi, Ghana and Zimbabwe.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, the United Nations Goodwill Ambassador on Malaria in Africa. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence.
You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band. If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Dr. Yasmin Adam, who is head of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Now, continuing with our discussion, building female leadership capacity, I believe, is important for women's development. How do you see the medical profession building this capability and mentoring women in more senior roles?
I think medicine in South Africa is probably one of those fields where at a specialist level we don't have any issues with gender and we don't have any issues with race anymore. So most of the people that we have are there on merit. And there isn't a problem. There isn't a problem with female doctors in leadership positions. So I have hardly ever seen a male doctor not want to take guidance or management, you know, from a woman. So it's been none of those things. So I think that certainly I think in obstetrics and gynecology we don't have any issues with that. So the woman, the doctor in charge of obstetrics, is also a woman. We have 2 women who head up our diabetic obstetrics clinic. We have the head of medicine, maternal medicine, is a woman. So there's a lot of those things, you know, a lot of those leadership roles. The head of fetal medicine is a woman. And so it gets better.
So you would say in terms of transformation within the obstetrics and gynecological area discipline that has occurred and we are seeing the right ratios of gender,
yes,
in those positions.
Yes. So I think the 50-50 starting off at medical school pays. I think that the medical school criteria for looking at disadvantaged people, people coming from rural areas, all of those things, so that when you get to the specialist level, it just shows that, you know, we don't have any issues with getting those ratios correct.
That's a great thing to see, and yeah. I think it's a really important learning, because often what I found within, I suppose it's not really the private sector per se, but when I look at ratios within government, we can see that we are already there on a 50-50 level. I mean, currently, although we slid down in the rankings this year in terms of interparliamentary union, but our composition of gender is now at 41%, women versus men in parliament versus 45% as it was in 2009. But still, it really shows progress, whereas if you start to look within the private sector and top management level, we're at 21% in terms of management, and it decreases the higher up you go. So 17% on directors, down to only 3.6% at CEO level, which I think is shocking.
Yeah.
In terms of the work that you do, the field of medicine is particularly demanding concerning your responsibilities as a professional, but also you have to encompass the fact of being a wife and being a mother to three children. How do you manage everything? Do you think that there's a right formula for it all to work?
I think that whatever you do, you have to do well. And if you're starting to make compromises on one side or the other, then you need to think whether you can do all of those things. So you don't want to have to go home and be guilty that you haven't helped your child with homework, or you haven't gone to watch the swimming, or you haven't done all of those things. I think then you need to consider which is important. But at the same time, you have to have support from your family, because you can't, if something happens and if something needs to be done, you need to go back to work. And that could be at night, it could be a Saturday, it could be a Sunday. I remember driving to Barra at night because the electricity had gone. Not that I could provide electricity, but so that I could just support the people and be there for them. And I think they appreciated it. My husband never noticed that I'd left. So.
And the children?
The children, they stopped noticing when they became teenagers.
But I'm sure it also provides a certain amount of independence and responsibility to your children to look after themselves, to become more independent in their roles and respect the profession that you're involved in. I'm sure form an incredible role model to them of what women can do and what they can achieve.
I have two daughters, and I think they're very independent, and I think they will be successful. And
have they chosen a line within medicine?
No. My oldest daughter is an actress, and the middle daughter is in media, and my son is still at high school, so he has to decide.
I see what you mean about the independence. So they've definitely got independent thinking with what they want to channel their futures to. With obstetrics and gynecology being a gender-specific discipline, because obviously it is about looking after women, according to Stats SA, in 2010, there are approximately 1 million live births in South Africa, and it estimated there about 40% of those births were in Gauteng. And you mentioned earlier that you have delivered 23,000 babies a year. And you also said that we've got a 70% increase in specialization was in terms of the ratio between women and men in gynecology and obstetrics, that there's a 70% to 30% ratio. Do you think we need to see more women in the space or more doctors entering the space?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, it has to be on merit and what people enjoy doing, because I think if they enjoy doing that, they'll be good at it.
And do we have enough?
No, definitely not. So I think we don't have enough in terms of number of doctors to patients. We definitely don't have enough. We don't have enough specialists in terms of specialists to patients. But what we do have is a mismatch of, in private practice, for example, you've got low-risk patients that will be delivered by obstetrician gynecologists, and they could safely be delivered by midwives. So, you know, I think that's a problem, because I also think that obstetricians, you know, it's like over-doctoring. And as an obstetrician, you're trained to see what the complications could be. And as a midwife, you train to see what the good outcomes can be. And I think that's the difference. Also.
So looking at the level, based on the level between the responsibility, the qualifications of staff versus the ailments of the patients that they're treating.
Yeah.
That there's the mismatch there.
Yeah.
Due to the nature of the conditions treated by obstetricians and gynecologists, do you think that as a female doctor that your female patients possibly feel more comfortable with you attending to them as a woman? And do you think that women have greater empathy towards female patients than male doctors?
I think that women do prefer to be treated by women for gynecological and obstetric medical problems. But I don't think women have more empathy.
Women doctors?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that I've seen some of my, the doctors, some of the male doctors who have got so much of empathy. And not just because they married and they have wives or they have daughters and they would like, and they see this in their own, you know, and look back at their own situations. I just think that we're lucky at the moment to have that particular.
So it's more individual characteristics, yeah, as opposed to gender specific.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, an ambassador for the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka every week on this day at this time.
You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance on frequency 9625 kilohertz on the 31-meter band. If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Dr. Yasmin Adam, head of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. During the course of our conversation, we have looked at the various progression that we've seen in obstetrics and gynecology, the evolvement and transformation of the discipline, and looking at some of the key areas Dr. Adam's work governs. And Dr. Adam, one of your areas of specialization is treating cervical cancer precursor lesions. And one of the major causes of cervical cancer is human papillomavirus. And I read that cervical cancer is responsible for the deaths of over 3,000 women in South Africa per year, which is a huge number. And in South Africa, the Minister of Health launched the government's HPV vaccine campaign to vaccinate, I believe, 500,000 girls across 17,000 schools. What are your thoughts on that initiative?
I think that if you're right that the number of, I think we see between 5,000 and 6,000 new cases of cervical cancer. And if you think about the figure that you see,
5,000 to 6,000 new cases a year.
Yes. So if you look at that and you say 3,000 deaths, so that's 50% of women who will die from that condition. So these cervical, the peak age of cervical cancer is like in its 50s. So if you're saying that these are women over the age of 40, so these are women who still have got young children. And so they're also economically active, and they've got social responsibilities. So it's not a nice cancer at all, from that point of view. As far as the vaccine is concerned, it's shown a lot of promising results. So we don't know the final answer because the precursor lesion is a surrogate. So it for from HPV
infection. Can you just
infection.
Explain that a little bit more in terms of surrogate?
So from HPV infection to cervical cancer, we think that takes between 20 and 30 years. But the precursor lesion comes before. So you've got infection with human papillomavirus, and then you get the precursor lesion. And this is where I work. So if you treat the precursor lesion, we will reduce the chances of cervical cancer. But once you've got the precursor lesion, we will never, even if we treat it, we won't reduce your risk to naught. So there's still a 5% chance of that woman developing a malignancy, even if she's been treated, that risk will always remain. The thing about finding the precursor lesions is that it's either using a pap smear or it's using HPV screening, which we don't do at the moment. But you have to then screen women to find it, and once you find it, you have to treat it. So it's like three stages. It's doing the pap smear, making sure the woman comes back for the pap smear, finding a place to treat that lesion, treating it, and then she needs to be followed up forever. Whereas with the vaccination will stop the HPV infection. But the vaccination is against two high-risk HPV types, or four HPV types, two of which will be low-risk. So there's two vaccines that are registered with the MCC. One is the bivalent, which is two HPV types, and the other one is the quadrivalent, which is four HPV types. But both of them target 16 and 18. 16 and 18 will still... 16 and 18, that makes up about 70% of the cancers that we get. But 30% will still be due to other HPV types. So even with the HPV vaccine, you'll reduce a large number, but you won't take it away completely.
And at what age are girls or should girls be vaccinated?
All of the studies and all of the information we have is that the vaccine should be given before they have HPV infection, so before they're sexually active. So it's between 9 and 12, and then there has to be, so it's we as far as I know, we're going to be using the two doses. So the first dose and then a 6-month dose. Or I'm not sure whether it's the first dose and then the next dose is in a month, but it's two doses, which will reduce the cost. And two doses, there is work which shows that two doses are better than no doses, but three doses would still be the best. But look at this. This is, you'll only really know in 30 years. But there is a reduction in the precursor lesions in those countries where they're giving it. So the UK is giving it. The US, the uptake is not 100, it's not even 80%. Australia, there's a good uptake, and I think in Australia they're already looking at catch-up. So women who haven't had it may still have it later on. So their first initiative was to give young girls between the ages of 9 and 12, and then there was a catch-up phase.
So it's an established intervention that, yes, we'll only know in real terms what happens in 30 years, but we've already seen successes in other countries where they've been running the programs.
Not in terms of the cancer, in terms of reducing the precursor
lesions. Reducing the lesions. Yeah. And Dr. Adam, any other countries in the continent that are investing into the vaccine?
See, other countries can use, their vaccinations paid for, so they, by the World Bank. South Africa is in this mid-income, and they can have their vaccinations much cheaper.
Dr. Adam, one of the things that I find curious is in terms of education of girls, particularly talking about gynecological or obstetrics areas, do you think that we as a country are doing enough to ensure that the right knowledge is disseminated across platforms and passed on, whether it is from mothers or teachers to daughters and children, especially in underprivileged communities? One thing in the media is talking about teenage pregnancy, that there has been increased incidences, and I'm sure that in your area you must come across a number of teenage pregnancies, and I'm not sure what the frequency is of the cases that occur.
So at our hospital, teenage pregnancies, we see between 5 and 10% of women who are teenagers. I think that the figure probably sits around 5%. There is a feeling that the teenage pregnancy rate is reducing, but that the abortions from teenagers is increasing, and that may be what's causing the rate to decrease.
So they're not going to full term, they're having abortions.
Which is not the right thing, because you shouldn't use abortion as a contraceptive method. I think abortion saves lives. I think there's no doubt that the maternal mortality from abortion has gone down to naught in some places in South Africa because of the safe abortion. So it's definitely extremely important. But my feeling is that it can't be government. It can't, you know, that education has to start at home. And that part of it has got to be with gender differences. It's the way mothers and fathers are different towards their girl children than they are to their boy children. And, you know, like if with a girl child, she can't go out at this time and out at that time, and she's got to be in by within a certain time. You should do the same with your boys, because they should be equally responsible. And the problem with teenagers is that I think that we focus on teenage pregnancy, but we should focus on adolescence, because it must be boys and girls.
So adolescence as behavior.
Yeah.
And how children are growing up, how they mature, how they go through adolescence, puberty, etc., and look at those developments as opposed to going teenage pregnancy.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of social dynamics that need to be included.
I think so. I saw that when there was a boycott in one of the schools recently, one of the issues that they had written down was that the school system and the education system is not doing enough about teenage pregnancy. And I don't think it can be one particular area or one, you know, the blame cannot sit at the door of the Department of Education. It's got to be, if all the players have to be together. And there certainly is a social dynamic. I think that teenage pregnancies are more common in women who have themselves had a teenage pregnancy.
So it's sort of a vicious cycle,
yeah,
that perpetuates.
Yeah. But having said that, I think that it's if you break the social problems, if you take away the socioeconomic problems, you'll make it better for everybody. And girl children should be compulsory that they go back to school after a baby.
In a way, that almost cuts them off from their futures, because without a matric, that just puts a total block in terms of where they're going to go in their direction and their careers.
Yeah.
But I guess then at that point, then there's looking at, well, who's looking after the child? How do we provide those support systems? Do we have nurseries to take care of them so that we've got that support to help them?
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons grandmothers look after children in our society, in our community, is so that they want their own children to be able to progress and continue to study or go out to work. Because you would make that, if you were a mother of a child who had a child, you would want your own child to continue to go to school and look after the child. And I think that's where also grandmothers look after so many children.
Yes, because you want to see the best
for your child
and you don't want anything to hinder them. I think that's a really interesting observation that you've made there with grandmothers investing their time and looking after children. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Balka every week on this day at this time.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Dr. Yasmin Adam, who is head of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. And now, Dr. Adam, in closing the discussion, given what we've just been talking about, what message would you like to pass on to girls and their mothers regarding underage or unplanned pregnancies who are listening to the show across Africa?
I think we have to accept that teenagers are sexually active. And so we need to make it as safe as possible. I think it's not to say that, I think if you know that it's happening, that you should make it as safe as possible. But that it is best not to be sexually active until much later. You should treat it like alcohol. Shouldn't drink before you're 18, and you shouldn't have sex before you're 18.
Dr. Adam, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, and thank you for sharing your insight. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.